Of all the angels, Hamilton was the one who turned Gust's knees to jelly. She didn't know anything about defense, but Charlie didn't rely on staffers to do his thinking for him, and he loved to watch the reaction on his guest's face when he would ask his defense aide to sit in on conferences. As he saw it, a big part of the job was entertaining the defense lobbyists, who contributed mightily to his campaigns. Hamilton, however, was not exactly a good-time girl, and she was frankly appalled on this weekend junket by what she perceived to be a clear abuse of congressional power. Charlie's entourage was jetted onto the carrier's deck, where the great hooks brought the U.S. Navy jets to a screeching halt. That night, the captain, in dress uniform, had a marvelous dinner on the deck with the sounds and sights of the U.S. Empire playing in the background. To Hamilton's discomfort, she was well aware of the strict prohibition against alcohol aboard a U.S. Navy vessel. Charlie had somehow managed to bring a healthy supply of liquor along. He hadn't served as gunnery officer sneaking whiskey aboard in empty shell casings for nothing. Hamilton's unhappy memories of the evening are of a frightening sea of 17-foot waves, people drinking, and everyone going to excessive lengths to accommodate the congressman and his date. It was meant to be one of those old boy weekends where a bit of good, clean fun can be carried out without anyone tattling. But nothing Charlie does ever remains a secret for long, and to Annalisa's horror, Jack Anderson's column, carried in the Washington Post and some 400 newspapers across the country, spelled out in humiliating detail how the congressman had taken a beauty queen for a weekend boondoggle at the taxpayer's expense. The story, which made page one of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, didn't sit well with Ilchenko's parents. Charlie personally apologized to them, then magnanimously offered to pay the Navy $650 for Annalisa's expenses. In response to reporters, he explained that he had only brought Ilchenko along so that Hamilton, his staffer, wouldn't feel so isolated being the only lady on board. Finally, after tending to this damage control, he begged Annalisa for another chance, promising that next time he would take her on the trip of her life and he would pay the bill. The experience Charlie offered his new love was the product of much thought and a kind of boldness about junketing that only a compulsive risk-taker like Wilson could propose. The trip began in Marrakech, where he had the Pentagon reserve the Churchill suite at the exotic La Mamounia Hotel. Since Charlie was officially on a fact-finding trip for defense appropriations, the Pentagon sent along a liaison officer to take care of logistics. There had to be a technical reason for being in Morocco, so Charlie paid a visit to his friends in the Royal Moroccan Army to watch them blast guns in the desert. "You see, I was evaluating anti-communist activities because I was getting my way paid. But then, of course, I had to find time to lie out in the swimming pool with Sweetums and take her to the bazaar." It was even better for Sweetums in Venice, where Charlie had arranged a magical dinner and gondola ride on the Grand Canal. This leg of the journey was more difficult for Wilson to justify, but he managed to. "Fortunately," he explains, "the Air Force base in Naples felt a great urgency to give me a briefing in Venice and sent two generals, as I recall." And then the pied de resistance, the overnight trip to Paris on the fabled Orient Express. Wilson had the good sense not to bill the U.S. government for this exotic leg of the trip, but the Pentagon added a pleasant flourish by sending along an escort officer to make sure everything was perfect during their travels. It was June 1, 1985, Charlie's birthday, and the young officer came dressed in formal uniform for the champagne dinner, with Charlie in black tie and Sweetums in the stunning dress he had bought her for the occasion. This spectacular Morocco to Paris junket for Sweetums was clearly stretching the rules of reasonable conduct, even for a senior member of Defense Appropriations. But in fairness to the congressman, he was only doing what he had been taught to believe was standard operating practice. As with most things, one's first experience is seminal, and few newcomers have been offered such a blinding insight into the way things work in Congress as when Charlie Wilson first joined the Foreign Affairs Committee in 1974 and was invited by the chairman, Olin Tiger Teague, to attend the Paris Air Show. "Well, Tiger, I don't have the money," explained the embarrassed freshman. Teague laughed, and Wilson remembers his astonishment at discovering that the U.S. government pays for first-class plane tickets and first-class hotels, provides funds for meals, and supplies limousines, foreign service officers as guides, and, of course, the best seats at the air show. All of this is free, with the objective of providing the legislators with a fact-finding experience that will make them wiser when they come back after the break to design legislation. What left the deepest impression on the novice congressman, however, was the way the senior Foreign Service officers at the embassy threw themselves into helping the committee members' wives find the best shopping deals in Paris. After Charlie had spent 2 weeks living better than he had ever imagined possible, the Air Force plane landed at Andrews Air Force Base to reveal a demonstration of respect for the power and prestige of the House that would linger with Wilson for the rest of his days in Congress. Two lines of station wagons were lined up on the tarmac, each one with the name of a member of the delegation prominently displayed on the windshield. No sooner had the plane pulled to a stop than a collection of uniformed men quickly moved into the cargo hold and placed the fruits of the junket-slash-shopping spree in the cars. Without so much as a thought about customs, the uniformed officers swept the chairman and his booty, two station wagons filled with antiques, off the Air Force base and into the district. That was when Charlie discovered how much fun being in Congress could be if you're on the right committee and if you know what to ask for. Over the years, Charlie became one of the all-time master craftsmen at bending the business of his appropriations subcommittees to the fancies of his private life. That was critically important for Charlie, because he had absolutely no money to spend. In fact, in the spring of 1985, the local Texas papers revealed that he had the distinction of being the poorest member of the Texas delegation, with a negative net worth estimated as high as $1 million of debt. For Charlie, the joy of being a congressman was that on a junket, money was not necessary. And as the Paris-bound Orient Express made its elegant way through the night on Charlie's 52nd birthday, the magic was working its spell on Sweetums. She was fast forgetting the humiliation of the USS Saratoga and finding it quite pleasing to be with this charming, handsome man who could make her feel like she was once again walking on stage at the Miss World pageant. For Wilson, however, this junket was fast turning into an agonizing and increasingly frightening experience. By the time he toasted Sweetums at his birthday dinner, he had begun to think he might be in serious physical trouble. There had been an incident in Morocco when he couldn't swim across the La Mamounia pool. He had assumed the chest pains were caused by dysentery, probably from the local cucumbers he had eaten with the Royal Moroccan Army. On the train, in his tuxedo, in between laughing and telling charming stories, he convinced himself that the lingering hollow feeling and the cold sweat was just the tail end of the intestinal problem. In Paris, Charlie was just one of a slew of senators and congressmen who make the annual pilgrimage to the air show. But since he was a senior member of Defense Appropriations, he knew that Sweetums would be pampered and spoiled by every defense contractor worth his salt. And, sure enough, the lobbyists had messages piled up at the hotel, invitations to dinners, cocktail parties, the theater. Paris was supposed to be the high point of the trip, but it was Sweetums's fate to have nothing but disasters accompany her on all her travels with Charlie. Coming back from dinner that first night, Wilson took 3 steps out of the restaurant and couldn't continue. "I took him up to the room," she remembers. "He couldn't breathe and he couldn't lie down. Later we found out he was literally drowning with blood in his lungs." A lifetime of drink had finally caught up with Charlie Wilson. His heart was literally soaked in alcohol and barely functioning, a condition not uncommon to alcoholics. When he got to the American hospital where Rock Hudson had just died, his blood pressure was so low that it took the nurses 32 tries to get an IV into his veins. In critical condition, he was evacuated to the U.S. military hospital at Rhein-Main, Germany, for preliminary treatment. The doctors there put him on blood thinners and drugs to force his devastated heart to continue beating. In his fog, after discovering that the hospital had been built by Hermann Göring for the Luftwaffe pilots, his imagination offered him an explanation as to why he was there. "I imagined myself as a wounded pilot from the other side who had just made it back with my Messerschmitt shot to shreds." 10 days into this fog, as if he were in fact a great war hero, he woke up to find the general in charge of the military hospital at his bedside, saying there was a call from the White House. The president needed him in Washington. Would he fly home immediately to cast a vote for Ronald Reagan to save the Contras? For an anti-communist from East Texas, this was a command performance. A giant Air Force plane was flown into Rhein-Main with a medical team on board to carry the congressman across the Atlantic to rescue the Nicaraguan freedom fighters. It made me feel like a big shot of immense proportions, he remembers.